Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everybody. This is Rick. I'm trying to get my act straightened out here. It's kind of hard. There we go. Okay. So today is the 22nd of March in the year 2010. So now let's get going with our questions for the day. The first one here. I discovered my husband's five-month emotional affair about 9 months ago. We have not had a real disclosure since that point. Many of things initially shared on his past were partial truths only or lies. Some I know the truth and called him on. Then about 5 weeks ago, I discovered that he had a porn issue and that in the spring of 08, he tried to find a local woman online by flirt.com and Craigslist. Still no solid disclosure on this either. He said that most of it he had forgotten about the online searches. He said he had brought out nothing for him or blamed it on his drug use at the time, making him into something he is not. But he went back into porn 2 months, and he's now been sober 90 days and lied about it again. He wants to tell me everything. That is what I need. And he wants to move forward into a better marriage than we ever had. He loves me and wants to be with me forever. I have such a hard time believing now that he says that he wants this marriage to work and that he loves me more than anything and will do anything to help me out in the marriage. But he felt that being completely transparent isn't fair because he deserves a long time too. I told him that a long time is not being denied at all, but just tell me that you need it and and where you were going and when. He got mad and needed to know where where he was and when he couldn't be reached. He said his BlackBerry on his hip at all times, that is the way he spoke to her all the time, so it's a source of pain for me. He lied about seeing his therapist. She double booked, and so he went to the beach to walk and have time alone to think. He said that he had gone even after she said that he never came that day. He lied twice to my face about admitting it and getting mad at me. I didn't call her to find out. It just happened that she had said something to me in another conversation. I feel like this is him not wanting to make this work and that he doesn't really want all of this. He said that lying is just what he's always done, and he's really trying so hard not to lie, even about stupid missed doctor appointments. He promises he's trying. I have so much pain over the struggle with doubt and trying to believe. I love him and want this to work. I want him to get better along with me. I want him to be the better person that he says he wants to be. By doubting him all the time, I just knock him down from trying and desiring because he'll see no point if I don't try to. What do I do? What to do? And I'm plagued with the pain of trust in him and his words and actions. But I'm also plagued with the pains of myself. I've never felt worse about me. I feel so weak. I feel so unattractive, no matter how much I dress up and get dolled up. I feel so exhausted from thinking and feeling. I feel so unlovable. I feel like he was looking for something better because I'm not good enough. So to begin with this one, I just want to say that this had nothing to do with, as I would say before, it just didn't have anything to do with you. This isn't about whether you're good enough or whether you're not good enough. So let's start with that particular comment. I think that he would have ended up doing what he has done, regardless of whether he was married to you or whether he was married to any other person. So this just isn't about you. Second, it always concerns me in a marriage, you know, how do we begin to create an environment ultimately where we can all kind of be honest and begin working towards something? There's, to me, it's scary a little bit from your perspective when someone continues to lie to you. I'm glad that he's trying to address the lying. But, you know, if I were working with him, I would certainly ask him, you know, specifically what is he doing to help with the lying? I mean, does he have a course of action, or is this just something that he wishes he could be better at? I mean, I think there are certain things, courses of action a person can take that really help with lying. And so just someone saying they're going to stop it doesn't mean that they're actually not going to do it. So I would hope in the long run that this person would actually begin to get some specific help, again, on what to do with the lying, because that is not a great way to begin to rebuild trust in this particular relationship. You know, I think that frequently one of the things that goes wrong for couples is they really pursue the wrong thing in recovery. To me, you know, the goal is, how do I learn to love another person? How do I learn to be concerned about other people? How do I begin to get the focus off of me and what I'm losing in this process? Because if you think about it, if his primary concern is what he's going to lose, that's still 100% totally self-centered. I mean, maybe all of us struggle with that as couples, but the men and the women, both hurt and unfaithful, that I know that do really well, really do begin to try to think beyond themselves and to consider what it must be like to live on the other side of them, and to try to become the person of integrity and character that they really feel in their heart they would like to be. And then they begin to put action to those steps and do what's necessary to make that happen. And I understand he's had drug use, and I understand all of that must have been really hard. And I agree with him that he deserves alone time, and maybe we all need our quiet time. At the same time, as we've talked about in earlier episodes, obviously, that to rebuild trust, there has to be a great deal of consistency, and it's difficult to get someone else to trust you if they don't first trust you, or to trust them if they don't first give you the information, trust you with the information they've got. And so hopefully he'll begin to trust you with more information. I just think that's imperative. And, you know, the image management, where we try to protect someone from knowing something, I think under the guise that maybe we're doing them a favor, that's not what begins to rebuild intimacy. Intimacy is the ability to be naked and not ashamed, the ability to let someone fully know you. And, you know, we've got to begin to kind of develop that rigorous honesty if we really want to have healthy relationships. And, again, hopefully, I guess the first step is to make that decision. You want the healthy relationship. And I do hope and pray that ultimately he'll do that and begin to take the steps necessary to begin to make that happen. Next one. I don't know how to start. I'm the hurt spouse. I never saw it coming. I found out in May of 2009, partial disclosure occurred. It took until September until I got more of the disclosure. Most of the information I have received from her has been because I received information from other people and confronted her about it. There are a couple of issues I would like to be advised about. First is trust. I have a very difficult time trusting that it's over and that she's told me everything, and what she's saying and doing now is genuine. She tells me that she's not interested in him anymore and that she's in love with me. She also said that she loved me through the affair, which I have a hard time understanding this as well. They both work together on different floors. She's told me that she has only seen him once since May. Hard to believe. I have access to her personal emails, of course, and phone records. I do not have access to her work emails or the IM account she has at work. The IM account is one of the ways they keep in contact with each other during the affair. Do I need to stop listening to my gut feeling, or should I move on and believe what she's telling me? Second, is the lack of showing remorse. She's done things for me that show me she's in love with me, and I hope they're genuine. She does not show any kind of remorse, however, for what she's done to me. I try to explain how I feel and the pain that's involved. She says she understands what I'm saying, it doesn't seem to trigger anything from her. She rarely says sorry for what she did, and that only occurs if I ask her if she is sorry. When I am the one in one of my low points, depressed and broken down from the terrible feelings that go along with this, she says she doesn't know what to do. I'm sitting in the chair crying, completely broken, and she doesn't even say sorry during those moments. She's not an unemotional person. I have seen her cry about things that are related to her. It seems that if she were remorseful for the pain she caused me, that there would be some kind of visible response directed towards me. I've discussed this with her, and she said she'd like to try to figure out what was blocking her from showing some sort of response. My gut's telling me that she's not remorseful for what she's done. This is some basic human response that is not there. And, of course, this also ties right back into the whole trust issue for me. Can someone please give me some insights? So let's start with the previous paragraph, which was, first is trust. Do I need to stop listening to my gut feeling, or should I just move on and believe what she's telling me? There are many reasons that people, because I don't know that I can give you a direct answer on this one. I think that if there are no signs that something is continuing, and depending on how far down the road and she's being consistent in terms of being honest and giving you access to things, understand she can't give you the work IM potentially, but then, you know, over time, that's just going to be a call that you have to decide that you're going to give her the chance ultimately. You're going to take the risk ultimately to let her hurt you again if you're going to recommit back in the relationship. Just like when she commits to you, she also gives you the chance to hurt her. Forgiveness and what I call future forgiveness is really about an understanding that potentially people mess up. And there comes a point when the pain has subsided and you watch the other person's response where I think you make the determination that it's worth to be back in this thing, and you move forward. Now, I'm very slow to tell people not to listen to their gut, even though I know at times, depending on how long things have gone, it may be that your intuition is right. I don't know how good you are at intuition. If that's, I think in the past, if the things that you have felt in your gut have always come true, I would tend to believe your intuition. If in the past, you know, sometimes you thought one thing and you found out in the long run that that wasn't correct, then maybe I would question your intuition. Ultimately, you'll have to make that decision, though, to give her a chance to hurt you. You know, that old saying, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. The only way anybody can ever keep from being fooled twice ultimately is to never take a risk. And that's the only way you'll ever be able to protect yourself from the perturbations of love. Just don't ever make a commitment, never fall in love with anyone, never give your heart to another, and you'll never be hurt. I think, again, watching her, seeing her, deciding whether or not, you know, she's trying to kind of walk how she needs to walk to be healthy, and if she's, again, the person you want to be with, and you choose to love her and be committed to her, then you're going to take that risk. And so moving forward to me isn't about assuming that nothing will ever happen. It's really about choosing to love another person, and hopefully they're living in a way where you can see that they're trying to protect you. And it's far more, I would say, they're living by right principles, and I think you can see a person's heart. And if you look carefully at your heart, I think you'll begin to know over time what you should do about moving forward. So just look in terms of previous stuff as to whether or not your gut's always accurate. If it is, then I would be slow to proceed. The lack of remorse thing is much more interesting to me. And I have had people on the lack of remorse thing where it has been up to 5 years before someone's actually been able to experience remorse. And the reason that it takes that long, sometimes there are wounds that occurred earlier in the relationship that the other person may not even be fully, she may not even be fully aware of some of those, or maybe potential resentments. I always say it's very difficult to, I think it's very difficult to work on the marriage until you first kind of get some assurance about the infidelity, and you see the other person's commitment back to the relationship to at least begin to work things out. Once that relationship, we've kind of reestablished that we're going to try to be us, it's not until then that you really begin to work on prior issues within the relationship. And so there may be some other things that have her feeling resentful, which may be one of the reasons she doesn't feel remorse. Another thing that can cause someone not to feel remorse is maybe a lack of understanding. You know, I don't get that sense from you. So in like 911 marriage, which we recommend, or the EMS weekends, one of the things that we address is empathy development, just really beginning to understand how you've impacted another person. And I find this to be especially true for women, that exercise that happens in like week 4, 5, and 6 is absolutely critical to helping shift them, and some men too, to helping shift them to the point where they actually can feel remorse for what they've done. And some of that is because, again, not knowing your wife, there's a defense mechanism, and it's almost like looking at that and what I've done to another person is so devastating that it would make it very, very difficult. I mean, for some people, just the thought of looking at that is crushing. And so I would, you know, you may find with her, and especially if you do one of the courses, which I'd recommend strongly, I think you may discover part of why she's had trouble showing remorse. And it may have something to do with her guilt. I just don't know. But I would recommend one of the courses in that situation. Next question. I was in denial about my sexual addiction for many years. I knew I was hiding something, yet was unable to look at it in terms of being an addiction. Could you talk about what it takes to break through that wall and what the steps are necessary to recover from it? That's kind of the denial I was just talking about in the previous one. And the thing about denial, when I work with somebody deep in denial, you know, sometimes I'll just tell them, you know, denial is one of God's greatest gifts. I mean, sometimes if we really looked at the full magnitude of what we've done and how we've impacted other people, potentially it might literally crush us. It might be more than we could bear. And so for that reason, I think that, you know, how you begin to work through that denial, that's why that's an important question. So what does it take to break through? To me, being with other people, a group of people who are trying to be rigorously honest and who have a different goal than image management. It's almost like if I have a if I'm with other people, like my group of brothers that I meet with, and they're trying so hard to be rigorously honest about themselves and just kind of doing their own inventory, man, that goes a really long way to helping me learn to be honest. I mean, just having it modeled for me. So I would begin by saying you need to be with other people who really believe in honesty and see honesty as being incredibly important. I think that, you know, maybe understanding also why we're doing this. If my goal is to please another person, then denial is going to be the only way to almost go to some extent. I mean, if I'm just trying to make you happy and I've got things within me that don't make you happy, or if I feel like the goal is for me to be good and I've got things that aren't good about me, then my goal almost requires denial. So another thing I think it's really important to move beyond denial is to say, okay, I've got a different goal than trying to be good. I have a goal of trying to be a person of integrity. Maybe I have a goal of trying to be a man of love. I have a goal of being, you know, someone with character. But when I make love the goal and not my image management the goal, if there's another goal in front of me where I'm trying to let go rather than trying to control, at that point, the secondary gain that's derived from denial goes away. So, again, shifting the game, shifting what we're about, shifting the main goal is another great way. As always, you know, that group of people, sometimes it can be found in Celebrate Recovery, maybe in Alcoholics Anonymous, in Sex Addicts Anonymous. But you got to be a part of some community that it's really not about being good, but it's really about being real and authentic and rigorously honest and about grace. And without that, it's going to be difficult to move beyond the denial. So, Rick, could you please talk about the anxiety the unfaithful spouse initially has when the spouse begins their own recovery work in the form of Harboring Hope or 12-step groups? Yeah. So a lot of times when the hurt spouse begins to go through the recovery process, what it does is it really spikes their emotional kind of grieving process. And maybe this is a place where I say a little bit about grieving, because this is really an important aspect. And, you know, grieving to me is one of the most important aspects of dealing with infidelity. I mean, this is an absolutely huge loss. And I keep saying this, but pain that is not transformed is always going to be transmitted. And the way that we have pain transformed, one of the primary ways we do that is through mourning. I mean, even Jesus said, "Blessed are those who mourn." Mourning and crying and working through this stuff is just absolutely critical. Looking at it, being able to walk into it, being able to come to the place of accepting it. The way that I know that someone has successfully grieved and come to the end of the grieving process is they no longer blame anyone. Even the unfaithful spouse has a lot to grieve and to mourn, maybe about ways in life that didn't work. But I always know when someone is a victim or they're blaming other people that they've not completed the grieving process. It's almost like those tears kind of cleanse the eyes and we get new vision when we're finally through the tears. And it may take a while, but once you get to the end of that, there is no blaming. There is a peace and acceptance that comes from properly having grieved something. Well, as you watch someone cry and get more upset and begin to walk through it, for the unfaithful spouse, their tendency is to want to feel more guilt. They want to somehow stop the grieving process because, and it's totally self-centered. Why they want to stop the grieving process? But they want to stop that grieving process so that they don't have to feel as badly about the magnitude of what they've done. I mean, I think watching another person grieve is really uncomfortable for us if you haven't walked through a lot of pain in your life. And it's especially difficult, I think, just the remorse that we were talking about in one of the earlier emails that begins to happen when you see that. But I just think the amount of pain that someone goes through when they really begin to look at it certainly makes it difficult for the unfaithful spouse. Another thing that can make it difficult for the unfaithful spouse is fear. And what they fear is that as they talk to these other people, again, this is totally self-centered, but their fear is that maybe they'll choose not to be with them, or somebody will put other ideas in their head, or maybe things will become more unmanageable. And we somehow think when things begin to become unmanageable that that's bad. I would actually recommend that when things begin to become unmanageable, that's actually quite a good thing. That's usually where all of our growth happens. So rather than being afraid of the unmanageability, you know, my suggestion is just accept that things are going to get worse. They're going to be difficult, but not to fear it. If you really believe that there's a God, then trust me, regardless of what your mate's exposed to and what they, you know, they go through, ultimately, it's still going to be God. It's not going to be them. And yeah, you don't even want to try to manage it. It's far better for you to be out of the way and just taking care of yourself. You know, it's, I've said this before, but one of the messages I gave Stephanie when we began our process was just simply, I'm not going to try to save the marriage. My goal is to try to be who God wants me to be. My goal is to try to listen to God and not try not to disappoint you, but try to not disappoint God, disappoint my, you know, my heart. I mean, doing what I know to be right. And I think sometimes when the unfaithful spouse has trouble with their hurt spouse doing Harboring Hope or not or 12-step groups, the problem gets to be if they're still trying to save the marriage, they just need to get their eyes off their mate and get focused on what they need to be focused on. Here's a comment from the question from the forum. A local counselor we've both seen has told me for 3 years that my husband is possibly the most extreme narcissist he's ever run into, and I'm finally understanding and able to accept what this means for me and for my marriage. It's always been and always will be about him. He's the center of his own universe and thinks he should be the center of everyone else's too. It's highly unlikely that he'll ever be able to admit any issues he might have, let alone work on them. Any regret he may feel has nothing at all to do with anyone but himself and what it cost him. Any feelings of love I once had for him are pretty much gone. Dead. And I'm now ending the marriage so I can move on with my life. How should I respond to his tears of sadness at this point? When I'm very aware that it has nothing to do with me, but only his feelings of loss. You know, again, in this sort of situation, I think that, you know, I can still be, as long as you're not worried about him trying to get it. So the first thing I would say is, in that sort of situation, do not think that it's about the other person trying to get it. So if you already know that he's not going to get it, don't continue trying to get him to get it. That being the case, if you're not worried about trying to get him to get it, you know, if it's your natural response, at least to be able to comfort someone who's grieving, even if it's for themselves, you'll find that you're going to feel better about yourself in the long run if you're able to let yourself be natural with that response and not just say, look, I feel horrible. I know this is really hard for you. It must be awful. But the fact is, I know what's best for me, and for that reason, I'm ultimately going to be moving on. Let's see. Can you explain the importance of the aftercare group connection for support post EMS, post 911 marriage? Yeah, I mean, I couldn't just say critical, but I can tell you when people are on a journey, I think we all need a community of people to encourage us, to hold us, to pray for us, to support us. And the couples that do the best stay in community and have others continually lifting them up and have others continually, I think, encouraging us and keep us kind of from falling back into old ways. The way I look at it is we all have a default mode, that old consciousness that ultimately brought us to this place. And so we need regular heart and mind recalibrations to keep from going back to old ways and to learn how to look at this thing in new ways. I think when you do the 911 aftercare program or the EMS aftercare program or any of those things, those are critical for continuing to kind of find new ways to look at this and to find new solutions and to develop new skills. So, one, the aftercare programs are really important for that ongoing recalibration, that new consciousness, like we've said before. You can never, as Einstein said, you can never solve a problem with the same consciousness that created it. Without the 911 aftercare program or the EMS aftercare program, you're not continuing recalibrating for that consciousness. And the second thing is, we don't know everything. I mean, we're just not that smart. I mean, we go into marriage, I think, very ill-equipped. And the aftercare program, I think, does, certainly that's an attempt to help you develop a new skills, new tools, new ways of relating, new ways of growing your relationship. So I would certainly hope that people would take advantage of those resources, because I think they're critical. Can you explain, here's another one, can you explain how valuable a tool polygraph testing can be, and also why an unfaithful spouse might be willing to do this? You know, with the polygraph, to me, first and foremost, is a tool that I think is useful not for the hurt spouse, just my honest opinion, but it's actually very useful for the unfaithful spouse, because it kind of is at a place where it causes them to have to really search their own heart, their own mind. It kind of puts an extra impetus. Now, I don't recommend a polygraph to everyone. And so, you know, for a lot of the hurt spouses, I don't know if I'm kind of enough for the unfaithful spouses. If I really see a genuine heart attitude to kind of unfold, you know, to work on things, kind of their own desire to deeply move into the truth and trying to unfold themselves. I mean, I don't know if the polygraph serves any sort of purpose. And a lot of that happens, I think, more with the therapist or in group than it does with the spouse. Usually the last place that a person is able to be fully intimate, even though it ought to be the other way around, is with our spouse. For a lot of men, what I find, interestingly enough, are women, is that they're able to share with their group long before they're able to share with their mate, or at least days before they can share with their mate, just because it's safer and it takes a lot of courage to deal with the marriage. Now, to the second half of the question, that was my second half, which is, why would an unfaithful spouse be unwilling to do a polygraph? I've had several things I've seen over time. Some people have really felt the polygraph to be, like, to them, an invasion of privacy. And so they've got to begin to develop maybe different ways of kind of looking at it. But sometimes that takes a long time. Some people actually do have trouble passing a polygraph. I mean, not because they're being untruthful, but there really is a percentage of people where polygraphs don't work. I mean, for me, I much prefer to see a polygraph being used more as a resource in somebody's individual therapy, and then where it can be presented to the mate farther down the line, if that would kind of help them. There are times when you've got, though I agree, maybe a hurt spouse who is really having trouble believing because there's been a long-term issue with untruthfulness. And in that sense, the polygraph can be useful, but he might not be willing to take it, A, because he's angry, may not be able to take it because, I mean, I think what we all think about is the fact there may be other information that he hasn't shared. I will say I don't think it's always about other information a person hasn't shared. It can be a power struggle. It can be almost your own shame for not being believed. It can be a fear that if the process between a husband and a wife has gotten to where it's requirement-based, then the only way you can prove things is by jumping through hoops. Sometimes people say, I'm just not jumping through any more hoops, and so then they dig their heels in at that point. I mean, ultimately, the recovery process needs to be, I hope that what I'm always doing in recovery, answering this question, what's in my mate's best interest? Because I think love always acts in the best interest of the other person. And I would hope that, like, if the unfaithful spouse is unwilling to take a polygraph, I would hope that the primary reason for not taking it is love. And if not, they need to kind of work through, you know, again, what's in their mate's best interest and kind of where are, and again, I say all of that to say there may be other issues that make it incredibly difficult for someone to take a polygraph. And it can go back to a raw spot, something they've got in their childhood about never being believed and what's triggered. So I think each particular case is a little bit individualistic, but I hope that gives you some ideas of reasons someone might not be willing to take one. Polygraphs are not also, in the long run, I will say, they're not always accurate. And some people have a fear about that. I mean, I've certainly had people who failed polygraphs who I think were being completely truthful. But because of the nature of the polygraph and the way the polygraph is administered, you know, you know, and their anxiety around a particular issue, they may have gone to the polygraph. And so then that opens up a whole other can of worms, especially if there's not anything additional to add. And some people are afraid to take the polygraph because they get into that situation then. Hopefully that'll help a little bit about why people might not take the polygraph. In the long run, I will say, to close on the polygraph issue, the polygraph, though, in the long run, really, I don't think needs to be a tool that's used or shouldn't be used as a tool to continue to give assurance over time in the long run, maybe for a short period of time, especially if there's a long history of chronic deception. But at a certain point, I mean, ultimately, you don't want the relationship to be requirement-based. You want to see your mate's heart and what they're trying to do. And, you know, you want to be able to find how you as a hurt spouse, for instance, can recommit. How you can ultimately trust and love them and kind of move forward. I mean, that's going to be your issue because I know the deceit was there, but you can't live in a system forever of distrust. You have to assume the other person at some point, and especially if they're showing signs that they're doing this, is actually trying to be real and authentic and intimate in a relationship, because healing and reconnection is never going to occur if you feel like you've got to take a polygraph to keep somebody under the gun in the long run to grow the relationship. Let's see. Now, there is a radio archive taking the polygraph that I recommend. It's I think you can search for polygraph, and it's with Bruce Stevenson. I don't know the exact date. Maybe Aaron can find that for us at some point, but that would also be another resource. Let's see. What do you do when the unfaithful spouse is concerned more about his emotional safety than being a safe place for the hurt spouse? What do you do when the unfaithful spouse is concerned more about his emotional safety than being a safe place for the hurt spouse? Well, I mean, I think that if the unfaithful spouse is concerned more about his or her emotional safety than being a safe place for the hurt spouse, again, I'm going to say there's probably a need for some work on the unfaithful spouse's part. It means that they probably don't have a lot of ego integrity at that point. And it's probably an indication of kind of where they come from. And hopefully in that process, they're going to do the necessary work, such as 911 marriage or the hurt spouse or the unfaithful spouse program that we're trying to bring up, where they grow enough in terms of their own sense of self. They're able to begin to think beyond themselves, and they get out of the self-protective mode, and they get into how can I help you heal mode. And to me, that's going to happen through group work or through individual work. And so I guess the first thing is, what do I do when the unfaithful spouse is concerned? I would say I would try to get the unfaithful spouse in some sort of program so they can begin to heal. And then let them work through that over time. They're just going to have to do the necessary work to make that happen. For you, the hurt spouse, if you're trying to figure out how to live with somebody who's in that place, probably patience. I think that also marital therapy can be really useful in terms of the two of you beginning to process that. Because, again, if they're more concerned about their emotional safety than being a safe place for you, then if you don't have a third party probably helping to facilitate a lot of conversations, then you're probably not going to have very productive conversations. So getting a third party involved would be really important. Let's see here. I think that may be the last of our comments for the day. I guess so. So I want to thank everybody for submitting comments today. I really appreciate it. And I hope you guys have a good week. The 911 launch is going on right now. So if you know anybody who could benefit from the 911 online course, please have them go to 911marriageonline.com and just sign up for that list. You can also find it through affairrecovery.com, but get them to sign up. There's still a course giveaway that will close on Wednesday, so if somebody needs a free course, they could join there. And the last thing, if you haven't gone and looked at the comments that are being made on the course giveaway, one of the questions we're asking this time is, what's the most difficult part of recovery? And I think you guys would really find that to be pretty fascinating. I've also made an attempt to try to answer the majority of those comments or those posts so that I can maybe give some direction. So if you get a chance, go check those out. And I hope you guys have a good week, and we'll be talking to you next Monday. Oh, also, I forgot, there's an EMS weekend coming up this coming weekend. So that's another resource if you know anybody that's got problems this week. I'll talk to you guys later. Bye-bye.